Well, speaking of your tiny beings in your house, I saw one of your Instagram stories. You had a bowl of food for Hops. I think, what was it? You were like, oh, I got to give Hops his breakfast first. Do you remember that one? And this was before you said you were out of dog food. So I wasn't aware that you had run out of dog food, but the bowl that you put down to Hops, like, it's on camera for 2 seconds, and it looked to me like oversized chocolate chips, coconut shavings, and carrots. Tell me that's not what was actually in the bowl.
Coconut shavings? No.
Oversized chocolate chips, coconut shavings, and carrots. Obviously, it's not chocolate because that's poison for dogs, but it looked like, I'm just saying, as it goes by the camera real fast, it looked like big chocolate chips.
Those were chunks of dry dog food.
Okay. Wow, they look really big. They look like they were the size of, like, nickels.
No, they're...
Coconut shavings.
No.
Oh,
I know what you mean. Okay.
Are you talking about the omelet breakfast or whatever you made them on
Yes,
dog day?
There was one segment of that. You can see, I saved it as a highlight in my story. You can go see. So what I feed Hops, what I've been feeding him most mornings is some, you know, dog kibble from a reputable brand. I have been chopping up some carrots in there, like just like yeah, I take like that. Four baby carrots and chop them up and put them in because he likes carrots and it, you know, keeps his stuff working regularly. And then the other little bit you saw was a torn up slice of deli turkey, like, you know, boar's head oven roast turkey. I know there's too much salt in it, and that's why I don't give him a lot.
Looked like kind of a lot.
It wasn't even a full slice.
It looked like a big bowl of food for a small dog.
It was very close to the camera. It's actually like a cat food bowl. Hops is not a big dog.
Put that food and mold it into the shape of a dog, it would be about the same size as him.
No, not only is he not a big dog, but it doesn't even fill the bowl, and it's a cat bowl. Like, the bowl is, it wouldn't even hold the amount of water he would need to be a water bowl. That's how small it is.
All right. Anyway, you got bad planning on the dog foods. Now you're making people food for the dog.
Yeah. Because, like, I bought, like, you know, so the brand I get is, like, it's one of, like, the fancier brands that is not available in, like, your typical grocery store. You have to go to, like, you know, a nice pet food store to get it. And so, like, there are grocery stores here. They do sell a very small selection of dog food. And I looked at it all today, and I was like, it was all, like, total garbage. Like, the ingredients are, like, you know, water, sawdust, compressed meat byproducts. Like, it's like, it's all like the worst garbage you can possibly imagine. I'm like, I don't feel right feeding that to him, because, you know, I know he wouldn't care, but I care, you know. Like, it's about standards, and I don't want to, you know, put a bunch of crap in my dog. So I'd rather just
so you give him cold cuts. That's not really
a very small amount, and the reason why
that's the human equivalent of that dog food you rejected.
Agreed. But it's that's in very small quantity, and it's mostly because I wrap up the pill. He takes thyroid pills because he's old, and so I wrap up the thyroid pills in like a little bit of deli turkey, because it makes it easy to give it to him, and it's relatively low bulk, so it's not adding that much, you know, stuff to him. And then I just put, like, I tear up a few little extra strips of the turkey and put it in there so that he inhales his dog pellets. But it turns out, when you make food they actually like, you don't need to taint it with deli turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I did, however, I must say, whenever I've had to make him, like, chicken for, like, if he, like, gets sick and I have to make him chicken because he won't eat anything else, like, I've had to do it a couple times here and there throughout this dog. And
throughout this dog.
Whenever I do it, I always feel bad for him. I'm like, you know, the vets tell you, like, just boiled chicken.
Mm-hmm. I've done it for my dog multiple times as well.
Boiled chicken is terrible. Like, it's so flavorless. And you can't give them onion or anything else that could flavor it. And so I always do a little tiny pinch of salt in the chicken water.
They don't need salt.
And I always do a little dash of rosemary. He doesn't care, probably, but I care. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give him such incredibly bland chicken. So today I did the same thing, and I was, like, baking... I baked a couple of chicken breasts and three chicken thighs to make this big dog food mixture tonight, and I put a little dash of rosemary on top because it just felt so bland without it.
His sense of smell is 10,000 times more powerful than yours. It's probably overwhelming him with rosemary, which dogs do not seek out or like in any way. It's not food for you. It's food for the dog. Empathize, but you need empathy for the dog.
Believe me, all the work I put into this food.
It's like 10,000 rosemaries in his face.
Well, it's pretty good, so... I feel like it allowed me to feel good about feeding him the meal that he seemed to really love.
You're supposed to be empathizing with the dog, not you. We know you.
The only downside is I have no idea how much of this mixture I've made to feed him. And he certainly won't tell me because he'll just inhale as much as I give him because it's really good. So I don't know if I'm feeding him enough or too much. I guess I'll find out after.
Like, you can do it by volume. Don't you have like a scoop that's like, this is the scoop for hops? Like whatever fits in this scoop is a meal, assuming it's reasonably packed.
I would give him like a third of a cup each meal of like the dry kibble. But, you know, this is totally different. This is like, you know, freshly made, like, you know, baked things with actual meat and actual vegetables and a little bit of rice. So it's like, I don't even like, I'm sure the volumes are not comparable because the kibble is probably so much more calorie dense.
You can just tell when it comes at the other end, when it becomes a uniform density, and you can say how much poop is there and how often.
I guess.
Then, you know, you're putting in the right amount when the normal amount comes out the back.
All right. We should start with follow-up as always. Andrew Bement writes, a way in which you can disable auto boot. So I was lamenting that, you know, I like to take a Mr. Clean Magic Eraser to my computers when they're powered off in order to get the finger grease and other, you know, bits off of them. And if I were to do that with the newer Macs, from what I'm told, they will turn themselves on as soon as you press any button on the keyboard. And some people wrote in with some like software tools to do this when the computer's on, which I'm not entirely keen on. But Andrew wrote in and said, the command you need, and we will put this in the show notes, is sudo nvram auto boot equals %00. And auto boot is Pascal case. Do I have that right? Capital A, capital B. Like I said, you'll see it in the show notes.
Continuing our segment of reading out command line things and source
everyone's
code.
Favorite.
We put them in the show notes too. It's a useful thing. Although I think I missed the last time you mentioned this, that you're using magic erasers on your computer. I don't really recommend that. Because don't they have like a mild amount of bleach in them? And I know they're kind of abrasive. So both of those things combined to make me think.
Those are both kind of incomplete. So what magic erasers are is melamine foam. And it's actually a really interesting material. It's basically a super fine abrasive formed into a sponge. And there's no other, at least in the regular kind, there's probably like different, you know, flavors now. But like in the regular kind, it's just a block of foam. And you make it a little bit wet to make it effective. But then it's basically a super fine abrasive. So they actually are really useful things to clean off a lot of different kinds of things. The problem with cleaning computers with them, they work fantastically on cleaning keys on keyboards, like on laptop keyboards. The downside is that because you have to put a little bit of water in them to activate them kind of and make them work, if you're scrubbing on a keyboard, there's a very good chance you're going to leak a drop or two of water into it. And I've actually seen this happen, and I've seen this cause problems. So that is the biggest reason not to use them. It's not about the you know, block of melamine foam itself. It's about the water that you need to use with it causing problems for the device that you're cleaning.
I still don't like the idea of using abrasive, and I think some of them do have a mild bleach in them. And the other thing is, if you're doing it on the keys, especially with these current ones, even if you get it wet, little bits can shed from the magic eraser.
That's
like tiny
true.
Little yeah. things. And I don't want, the other thing that our keyboards are vulnerable to is any little speck of anything. I don't want a tiny little speck of abrasive working its way into there. So all I'm saying is, Casey, like, follow the instructions on Apple's website, 75 degrees for the air.
Yes,
and
yes,
they always
yes,
say
yes.
like a clean, like damp cloth with just water. Like if say you have finger grease on there, right? Water, it's not as good as like a degreaser to get off finger grease, but it will eventually get off the grease. It is universal solvent. It will eventually get rid of the grease unless you have some serious like motor oil situations going on there. But I don't endorse the magic eraser.
That is noted, and I will promptly ignore you henceforth. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your Apple Card. I hear there's some trouble in paradise there.
Yeah, I got my, I applied for the Apple Card because now it's open to everybody, and I did the little thingy, and on the phone where you apply and you enter some small amount of information. It was very painless. My first sad realization was that my limit on the card was going to be $10,000, which is very low and not enough probably for the Mac Pro system I plan to buy. It's probably not that big of a deal, practically speaking, because my wife got a card too, and so I could buy like the monitor on her card and the computer on mine or something like that.
So you think,
I was going to say, you think the computer will fit on one?
Yeah,
I hope better. But like $10,000 is, not a high limit for a credit card in general. It's lower than any of the limits on any of my actual credit cards. And what I've heard since then of people complaining about the limits is that, they're being conservative because this is like the first consumer credit card Goldman Sachs has done, yada, 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 excuses. Anyway, I immediately went to customer service. And in addition to, going to the text chat to say, get me out of arbitration. I also said, and by the way, can you increase my limit? Because my experience has been if you ask a credit card company to increase your limit, they will. If you have good credit and all this other stuff. And like I have good credit. I have lots of credit cards with high limits. I figured they would do it. But their response was, at this time, we are not evaluating credit limit increase requests from customers who have had an account open for less than 6 months. So basically, no one's getting an increase for 6 months, which is kind of cruddy. By then, it will be too late. So anyway, that's my card situation. The other thing is I did get the physical card because everybody should, just even if you're never going to use it, because it's cool. And I was impressed about a couple of things. One, the Apple card, which is a normal size credit card, actually comes in packaging. I just assumed it would just be like, I don't know, like stuck to a piece of paper like other credit cards. But no, of course, Apple has to have packaging for its card. And as you would expect, the packaging is, you know, interesting in the details. It just looks like a folding piece of paper with a card inside it. But if you look at it closely, it's actually very clever and interesting and cool. And the second thing is you open it up and there's your little Apple card. And it's in this little slot, and mine at the bottom of the little slot, mine says, activate your card. What is the text here? Wake iPhone and hold here. That's it. Like, no, you know, when you get a credit card and it says to activate your card, call this number, and you got to go through some phone tree and you press a bunch of buttons and you enter a bunch of things to identify yourself and you activate your card and blah, blah. And it's not, it used to be more painful when you had to speak to a human, but even the phone tree stuff is annoying. To activate this card, it says, wake phone and hold here. It doesn't say activate Apple Pay. It doesn't say launch the wallet app and all that stuff. It just says wake phone and hold here. And that baffled me for a second because I'm like, just wake the phone? Do they mean like, do I have to unlock it? Or can I just tap the screen to turn it on? Anyway, I held my phone close to the thing and went, I thought for a little bit and went ba-bloop. And it said, you want to activate your card? I said, yes. And it activated. So it was the best credit card activation experience I've ever had. That said, my wife got her card and I was waiting for her to do the same thing. I'm like, you know, I wanted to her to experience the joy of activating a card without having to call somebody on the phone. But hers didn't say wake phone and hold here. Hers said like launch the wallet app and do something or other. Like it had her doing a bunch of other stuff. It had different text instructions printed on the bottom of the thing. And just holding her phone next to it didn't activate it. She had to actually follow those instructions. I think maybe it's because she didn't actually do any transactions with the card before she got the physical one. Cause I had already like paid for iCloud storage or whatever the heck. Wait, I, you know, had it set for.
Does she happen to have a super old phone that doesn't have NFC?
iPhone 10.
Okay, so that isn't it then.
Yeah, it's very confusing. But anyway, just to let people know what kind of activation experience they might get. They might get the really cool activation experience or the slightly less cool one, but both of them are better than using the phone.
I wonder why it's different. Like, why have two different ones going? I don't know.
I looked it up before. I know, like, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some, like, additional feature of NFC that allows it to be more passively, like, but I Googled all this stuff, and it's like, no, this has been a feature of iPhones forever. So you'd have to really have an old phone. It would know what phone she was using, because she had put it in her wallet on her phone. That's how you have to do that to even order the physical card. So that was all set up, so they know what kind of phone she has.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that was weird. And the card itself, which we'll get to in the next item. It's cool. It's white. I'm not going to actually use the physical card at all.
I've held one briefly when I was in San Francisco. I met up with a friend of mine who had one, and they are very fancy. They're very fancy. I kind of want one, but I don't know. I just don't feel like going through the whole rigmarole of unfreezing my credit and applying and getting it and freezing my credit again and blah, blah, blah. And I don't buy Apple stuff enough that I really think that 3% is going to make that much of an empirical difference in my world. Plus, I don't plan on buying a Mac Pro because I'm not a maniac, so I don't need to worry about these things. See how stress-free your life can be if you don't need to worry about the Mac Pro.
I also just like, just as a credit card user, I hate this new trend of nice credit cards being like heavy, thick metal. Why do you want your wallet to be unnecessarily heavier? Like, yeah. Plastic was fine for decades of using credit cards. Why are we changing this? This makes no sense. Like, I want the benefits that the high-end cards give you, but I don't get, like, can I opt for a plastic one?
Come on, Marco, treat yourself.
Wasn't someone was saying that, like, they were doing, like, market research on credit cards, or some company was doing market research on various premium credit card designs, and the number one factor by far in all focus groups was the thing that everybody liked about cards was the heavier equals better. Everything else varied, color, you know, shape, texture, designs on it, but heavier equals better was like number one with a bullet. So you might not like it, but apparently in the market of credit cards, heavier is more impressive is better. I feel the same way. Like I'm wrong. I'm not going to carry it around because I already have a MasterCard, so I don't need to have a second one. And I'm certainly not going to put a heavier one in there. And then the next thing we're going to get to is another reason I'm not going to include it in there. By the way, EH in the chat room says the iPhone 10 doesn't have background NFC scanning. Only the 10S and the 10R have it. So I have a 10S. And maybe that was my guess, but I kept trying. I didn't know what I was Googling for. I was Googling for like transit pass or some other NFC stuff, but everything I saw was supported everywhere. But maybe background NFC scanning. Background meaning, I guess, if you're not in an app, like, you know, because I wasn't.
That it can scan without being activated. Maybe that's really interesting. That makes sense.
So there you go. You only get the super cool experience if you have a 10S or a 10R.
That's also true of the shortcut stuff, right? Come to think of it, didn't they say that if you have a lowly iPhone 10 like I do, that I wouldn't be able to use the like tap to activate shortcut thing? You know, do you know what I'm talking about? Because like there, get like
but
an
that's,
NFC.
That's what I was trying to remember, but I apparently didn't know the right words to Google that there was some new feature in the 10S that had to do with like smacking your phone against something without launching an app, and this was it. I should have been looking for, I guess, background NFC.
Interesting.
All right, question answered.
There you go.
All right, John, tell me about how you keep your Apple Card feeling healthy, wealthy, and strong.
Yeah, this is one of those micro controversies, which I don't think there's anything particularly controversial about it, but it's an opportunity to talk about Apple's design decisions again. So Apple has a tech note or support article or whatever that is entitled How to Clean Your Apple Card. See how to protect and maintain the condition of your titanium Apple Card. So it is, you know, a very nice object. If you want to keep it looking nice, they have all these instructions about what to do, about gently wiping it, you know, damp cloth, lint-free microfiber, all the things they tell you about everything. Although they do mention isopropyl alcohol, which they usually don't mention for anything else. Don't use household cleaners. Don't use compressed air. That's just for our laptops. Don't use any aerosol sprays, solvents, ammonia, blah, blah, blah. So that's all fine. It's like they have those instructions for basically any Apple product. Like, how do I clean my whatever? You can probably find an Apple support article, which is good. You should look at because they'll tell you what not to use. But the part that got everyone up in arms was how to safely store and carry your titanium Apple Card. In particular, the passage that says, where is it? If the credit cards are placed in the same slot, your card could become scratched. So don't put it next to another credit card. The Apple Card needs to be by itself. And then the next bit, some fabrics, like leather and denim, might cause permanent discoloration that will not wash off. So, cool. Don't put it near other credit cards, don't put it in denim, and don't put it in leather, because you might permanently discolor your card. I think that's probably true of every credit card in our wallet. If you put it in denim or leather, they could be permanently discolored. Nobody cares, because who cares with your plastic credit cards, whether they get discolored? But Apple made this beautiful thing that they have instructions on how to keep beautiful. And part of the instructions are try not to use it like a regular credit card by putting it in your leather wallet or in a wallet where, like in those iPhone cases where it's exposed and then you put it in your back pocket of your jeans. It's not ridiculous. Who cares? Like, if you care about it, then care for it this way. If you don't care about it, just use it like a regular card. It'll be fine. It's not like it stops operating. This is all about how to keep it pristine. But this gets back to the discussion that I think we had maybe on this program or maybe it was Hypercritical Days. There was a big thing going around. I guess it goes around every few years. Let's send it around again about products that look, if not better, at least look good, wear their age well, like they wear well. The example people always putting in there is like a cast iron pan or like leather goods very often wear in a way that makes them attractive as they get used. It doesn't look the same as when they're brand new, and maybe they might look worse than when they're brand new, but they still look nice. They get a patina versus getting gross looking, right? For a credit card, like, honestly, who really cares? It's not actually a big deal. But if you were tasked with designing an Apple credit card and you had to go on the whiteboard and let's list the attributes, the favorable attributes that a credit card could have and the use cases, right? The use cases would have to include being put into a leather wallet and being subjected to denim. Like, those would have to be on the list. And the attributes would be, maybe you could say looks good as an attribute. I think you'd have to put, for this product and every Apple product, either stays looking good or wears its age well. And those items are very often not on the list of things of Apple for Apple products. I think they are sometimes, like the unibody aluminum and glass laptops, for example. I think they wear pretty well. Part of the criteria is they look good when they come out of the box, And I think they wear well. They don't stain easily. They don't chip. They don't scratch as easily as many of the alternatives did. They don't discolor like the plastic ones did or whatever. But it's hit or miss. Some products age well and some products don't. A lot of the iPods did not age well and they just look beat up and gross and not in a good way. But some of them did age well. Some of the iPhones aged well. Some of them didn't. This card seems like it's not going to age well because the design is this beautiful white sleek thing. And if it gets like streaked with blue, not really a great look. So I don't think this is a big deal, but it does scratch that itch in my head of like, you know, Apple, your things don't just have to look good in the product shots and when you take it out of the box, especially if you're going to use and handle it every day for years on end. It would be good if they aged gracefully. They can't be impervious. They can't be magic and not get damaged, but like try to make them age in a way, age evenly or get a patina on them. Don't say, oh, well, here's your brand new card. Don't stick it in your leather wallet because that's silly. And it makes it sound like what's going to happen if you don't do that is going to be an aesthetically unpleasing experience.
I understand why they had to publish this support document, even though it is ridiculous. Everyone's always looking for ways to call fail on Apple. They're in a very high profile position, and if there's any flaw with any new product they launch, the press will jump all over them for it. I understand. That's the reality that they're in. And so if they didn't post this document, there would be people whose Apple cards would get beaten up, as all credit cards do, after, a few weeks of being in a wallet at most. And they would take pictures and they would start a Reddit thread saying, look, my Apple card is defective. And it would be a big story. And Apple would have to deal with a PR crap storm that day, about why the Apple card is badly designed because it was defective, because it got banged up in a wallet, because all credit cards always do that. Instead, they designed it to be so sensitive to damage that they moved up the PR, crap storm of dealing with this. They just called it on themselves in advance by publishing this support document saying, all right, look, here's, if you keep your Apple card in pretty much any way that anybody ever keeps credit cards, it's going to probably get banged up. I kind of see why they had to do that because of the scrutiny they're under with anything new they launch. But it's still kind of sad that they had to do that. It is ridiculous. It is a hilarious document to read, even though, yes, they probably had to do it, but it is still funny. It does indeed happen to every credit card. And also, as John said, they also did design this one in a way that seems even more completely distant from reality than it was necessary. Nobody was forcing them to create a white credit card, for one.
It just happened to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep, it happened to be white.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice. Cool. Yeah.
But so the thing is, I can't tell though. Like you mentioned that like they made a card that is more susceptible to damage. At this point, nobody knows whether this card is any more susceptible to damage than any other credit card. Maybe it's less susceptible to damage. We just don't know because we all just got them and they're all brand new, right? But the article doesn't say, and by the way, unlike your other credit cards, this one will be discolored. Like, it could be worse. It could be better. It's hard to tell because the article is very sort of matter of fact and gives, the most cautious advice. Like, if you read the instruction manual for anything you own in your life, it's hilarious how they tell you, like, not to use it in the way. It's like Q-tips instructions telling you not to put them in your ears. Like, there's the instructions that come with the product, and then there's how everybody uses them. And with the Apple card, people are going to put it in their wallets. And I think we still will see, here's what my titanium Apple card looks like after 6 months in my wallet. Will it be better than if you had stuck a plastic card in there? Worse or the same? This article gives us no clue. But yes, the choice to make it white. Like, to give an example, I have other metal-ish cards or cards that don't feel like plastic to me. And a lot of them are either like black or very dark blue. And those might be getting all scuffed up from my leather wallet, but I would never see it because it's harder to see on a dark material. And it's not like that color scheme is foreign to Apple. Like, they make space gray and the dark colored computer stuff, like the Apple TV, for example. And also, dark colors and black cards have been like a premium thing, so they could have actually gone in that direction. Maybe they would have made the card feel too out of reach for regular people and they're going for the mass market to make it white, but they could make a black version of it. Maybe they still will make a black version of it or a gold one for the Apple Card edition, but
Actually, DLC would prevent a lot of the problems that they're guarding against here.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's kind of like, you know, if you make something beautiful and like if it really is more delicate than other cards, you ruin the beauty of it by having to stick it in some kind of protective sleeve or something.
Yeah, and I think also like the timing of this was pretty poor optics of like, you know, right now, like it after in right before what is hopefully the end of the butterfly keyboard era, right as, you know, Jony Ive has exited. And I think we've had kind of like the peak of the worst of Jony Ive style designs in a lot of ways over the last few years. I feel like Apple commentators and press are very like hypersensitive to anything where Apple is designing something for purely visual appeal in a way that will make it less practical or less reliable in the real world. And so to have this come out now when everyone's very sensitive to that kind of thing, and it seems to be exactly that. It seems to be like something that Apple designed in a vacuum that, you know, designed it to look good, but to be fairly incompatible with the real world. And whether it ends up that way or not, that is what this document makes it sound like. This document makes it sound like this thing is not at all designed to be used the way anybody ever uses credit cards. And so that, I think, it kind of like it hit a nerve in the Apple community and press of like, yet again, they're doing something that is form over function. And hopefully we're at the end of that, but we'll see how that turns out.
So you're going to have a special sleeve for your Apple card that matches your special sleeve for your iPhone, John?
So interestingly, when my bank sends me my debit card, they always send it in a sleeve. So I just always put it in my wallet in the sleeve. So like all my credit cards are just in these little pockets, but my debit card is in the sleeve that it came in.
Oh my God, John. No wonder.
Have you ever seen those little
like tear resistant material sleeves?
You've seen my wallet. It ends up being like a pocket liner because it's not as tall as the card. And when I pull the card out, the pouch stays in the wallet kind of, but yeah, it's one of those little sleeves. Some of your cards might come in them. People just throw them away.
You already have protective sleeves for a credit card in your wallet?
Oh my God.
I do. Just for my debit card, not for any of my credit cards.
Oh, yeah.
But it is nice. It does actually keep the cards nicer because if you compare it to the cards that are just in the leather slots, it's a little bit nicer.
But
anyway,
why?
I do have sleeves. I do have sleeves for this card, but I'm not actually going to put it in my wallet, so doesn't matter.
Oh my God, John. You're talking about like the thing that your global entry card comes in or comes
with? I don't have a global entry card, so I couldn't tell you. But yeah, it's a little sleeve, exactly the same size as the credit card. Often credit cards come in them.
God. Everyone's going to be so excited.
I don't know why you're so oh God about that. It's exactly like having a pocket. The sleeve doesn't, unlike the phone where the phone comes out with the sleeve on it and then has to be removed, it's just like putting it in a pocket, except my pocket is lined with Mylar. I think that's what they're made out of.
It's no wonder. I cannot believe you don't have severe back problems worse than Mike, given that you sit on a 4-foot-tall wallet every single day.
I've been thinning it out lately. It's getting thinner.
Okay, 3-foot-tall wallet every day because of all your stupid sleeves.
Why would I be sitting on it?
Oh, my God. It's in your back pocket.
It's not. We've gone through this multiple times.
I forgot how much of a monster you are. Anyway, can we move on? I'm getting so stressed out just thinking about your wallet. We were written by a lot of the internet, a sizable portion of the internet, to tell us that most modern cars actually have USB-C and typically USB-A ports as well.
I don't know most, but certainly a lot of them. Like we never got percentages, but people would say my car is X and it has some USB-C ports. My car is Y. Like, and so we saw lots of car models, but we didn't see enough of them to say that most new cars have it. But it seems like it's much more prevalent than we thought it was.
Indeed.
And the other thing is that they didn't get rid of the A's. Like almost all the cars, I think every single car that someone told us about had USB-C, but also still had A. Sometimes the C was only in the back seat, but it only had A in the front seat. So we're in some weird transitional period.
And tell me about your new or your forthcoming camera. Since you're not spending enough money on your Mac Pro, you're going to buy a new camera as well?
Well, whether I buy it or not, Sony did release the new cameras that we were talking about, new APS-C cameras. The numbers, I guessed wrong on the numbers. They had now, in addition to the 6,000, 6,300, 6,400, and 6,500, now they have the 61 and 66.
Of course.
And I think they revised the 64. But the good thing is the 66 actually is the best one. In almost all ways, the 66 is basically like the 64. It's got the advanced motion tracking and the new color chip and all the other stuff or whatever. And it has in-body stabilization, which the 6400 doesn't have. And it has the gigantic battery from the A7 series. So the battery was fine in those things to begin with. But now the battery is like twice as big. It's rated for like 800 shots or something. And that's a conservative estimate. So no problem with the battery. And they made the handle bigger, which both to accommodate the larger battery, but also because people have been complaining that the handle is small. I thought the old one was fine. But anyway, a bigger handle is not, or whatever you call it, bigger grip is not a bad idea. So it's about what everyone expected it to be. The only surprises slash downsides, as far as I can tell, are that it still isn't USB-C. Like, it's just like all the other of the Alpha 6 whatever series. It's that stupid mini USB, which is terrible. Like, they didn't... This feels like the final best revision of this generation of camera, and I hope, like, the next one will be, like, a different number, and it'll have USB-C on it or something. But anyway, no USB-C. Also, no USB 3. So it's still USB 2 through mini USB, oof, which is not great.
That's weird for something released now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, it makes sense if you look at the line. They're all exactly like that, but they revised all this other stuff, and they're like, yeah, USB 2 is fine. And honestly, it is fine. Like, they're it's only a 24-megapixel sensor, and if you're not shooting RAWs, it's not a big deal. And you can just take the SD card out and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But,
well, but, like, the A7 line went USB 3, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is the cheap line, you know what I mean? And the other weird thing about the 6600 is no flash. Which sounds like, well, who cares? And most people probably don't even know these cameras have flash anyway. But it does. It's very cleverly hidden. It's a terrible little very tiny pop-up flash. Honestly, I'm pretty sure I've literally never used a flash on my camera. But all the other ones have it. And it doesn't take up any room. And it's very unobtrusive. And you feel like, yeah, you could have put the flash there. But maybe they make up for it with more weatherproofing. Or maybe they need more room inside for the chips or whatever. So it's not a big deal. So anyway, 6600 looks like a really nice camera. The more exciting news for me, I think, because I'm still not sure about if I'm going to step up to the 6600, is they introduced a couple new lenses, and the one I'm interested in is a new 70 to 350 zoom lens, which is better quality than my zoom and has a longer reach. And yes, it's twice as heavy and slightly larger. But it, I think, is depending on what the reviews say about it, it seems like it is the best option if I want a zoom lens that is not tremendously bigger and has better image quality and has a longer reach. It's not a, you know, f4 through the whole range. It's the same, whatever, 4.5 to 6. Whatever, but it does have a longer reach and presumably has better optical quality. So I'm going to take a look at that, and it's not super expensive. So mostly good news on the camera front. I'm still debating, waiting, you know, anyway, I'm not going to be looking at cameras for a while, but come summer next year, I might just get the new lens and use it on my existing camera, or I might be looking to step up to full frame, depending on what they come out with there, but it's still good news.
I mean, I would say, given your proclivity towards, like, super zoom style lenses, you probably don't want to go full frame, because you get so many more, like, better zoom lens options, like super zoom lens options, with the crop sensor, like, because making it full frame would be, like, prohibitively, you know, massive and expensive and everything.
Yeah, but, like, I can't make an acronym of this, but I have full frame FOMO. I want more light in the camera. I want more pixels on the picture. I want the ability to crop things out. Like, I want all of that, and I haven't had that. Mostly the light thing, because I hate when I'm, you know, like I said, I never use the flash, and in certain environments, it's so dark that even with my quote-unquote good camera, I'm not going to get usable pictures without a flash, and I'm not going to use a flash, so I basically get grainy, bad pictures, especially if people are in a dimly lit indoor room and they're moving. Like, people, like, weddings, like, if someone is, like, on the dance floor in a wedding at night, it's, I'm not getting good pictures with my fancy camera. And I'm like, I need to, if I had a full frame, I'd have a better fighting chance. There'd be less noise. That'd have more of a chance of capturing the motion without ever being a blurry streak. Right. So I feel like, you know, maybe I'll regret it. Maybe I'll get full frame and say it's way too big and I don't care. And everything you said about the zoom is true. But I feel like I at least want to entertain the option. So I'm, like we said a couple of shows ago, the A7, just with no letter, 4, if something like that comes out, I might look at it. Anyway, I don't know. Mac Pros before that, lots of money to be spent, lots of years to wait, plus mm-hmm. the TVs in the mix somewhere there. So it's a long road to all these fancy things.
We are sponsored this week by the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast. Subscribe today in your podcast app of choice. For 2 decades now, Tech Meme is the website that people in the tech industry visit every day, multiple times a day, to keep up on the latest news. And for a year and a half and nearly 10 million downloads now, the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast has taken what techmeme.com is good at and distills it into podcast form. It's the same news headlines, same up-to-the-minute news, but also context and conversation around what happened today in the world of tech. This is Silicon Valley's Water Cooler Podcast. It's how you stay in the know if you care about technology. So Tech Meme Ride Home is a daily show. It posts every day around 5 p.m. Eastern each afternoon. It's only 15 or 20 minutes long, so you can get caught up really quickly with everything that happened that day in tech. These are top stories, top posts about those stories, top tweets and conversations around those stories, so you can really crucially get the context. You know, any bot could tell you headlines, but the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, it's kind of like TLDR as a service run by humans. They're online all day, reading all the blogs and tweets and deep dives so they can catch you up. And now the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast also has weekend bonus episodes with the journalists and newsmakers who drive the Silicon Valley narrative. So guests for this have included MG Siegler talking about phones, A16Z's Connie Chan on super apps, Mark Gurman on Apple, Federico Viticci and John Voorhees breaking down WWDC, Casey Newton on Facebook, the great Taylor Lorenz on all things influencer, Nick Kwa on podcasting, multiple Jay and Farad show reunions with Jay Yarrow of CNBC and Farad Manju of the New York Times. So it's a great podcast. Check it out today in your podcast app of choice by simply searching for Tech Meme Ride Home. And in fact, if you use Overcast, not only can you just type in ride and it appears right there in the autocomplete, it is almost always in the top handful in the most recommended podcast category. And I don't edit that. That isn't, you know, purchasable or editorial or anything. That's just the most recommended podcast among Overcast users, and it's always right up there. Check it out, Tech Meme Ride Home. Please subscribe in your podcast app today. Thank you so much to Tech Meme Ride Home for sponsoring our show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. I think it was the episode before last we were talking about whether or not Tesla was a joke, and one of the things I conceded was that Tesla's supercharger network seems to be beyond compare. And a friend of the show, Sam Abwelsamid of the Wheel Bearings podcast, which is neutral but with people who actually know what they're talking about, he wrote me to point out that according to energy.gov in the United States, I am not making any claims about anywhere else in the world, just the United States. He sent me a couple of screenshots that he took, and I will try to remember to put them in the show notes. But suffice to say, according to the U.S. government, Tesla has 737 stations in the U.S. and Canada, actually, for a total of just shy of 7,000 outlets. Meanwhile, if you combine all the other kinds of electric charging together, the number jumps from 737 stations to 2,407 stations, and actually a little bit fewer actual outlets. So there's more stations with fewer outlets, 4,191 outlets, as opposed to Tesla's almost 7,000. But the point is, there's actually a pretty good parity from the looks of it, with the exception of like the area of the country that's, I don't know, like the Northwest and Midwest. I don't even know what states these are. I'm so terrible. Like Iowa and thereabouts. Not so great coverage there, but just about everywhere else, it looks almost, you know, toe-to-toe with what Tesla has. And that was news to me. I assumed that if you were to buy anything but a Tesla, it's the charging story is basically good luck. As it turns out, I think my dad might be within 24 hours of buying himself a Chevy Bolt. So we'll see how that whole experience goes if he actually pulls the trigger. But as it turns out, there are more options for non-Teslas than I had expected.
Shouldn't be news to you because I brought up this exact same point the last time we were arguing about Tesla, like 6 months to a year ago. I think I went to the exact same website and looked up this info. Right? Okay. A couple of key things about the screenshots you sent on this website. He actually sent screenshots of US and Canada. If you limit it to US, it changes slightly, but the main story is about the same. Also, he applied the filter that only looks at, you know, DC fast charging, like the highest level of charge rate. There's a bunch of filters that you can apply that's like, you just want any kind of electric car charger, or do you want the fastest one? Like, because the superchargers are all, I think, the fastest ones. So to be a fair comparison, you have to limit the non-Tesla ones to also be the super fast chargers. And by the way, there are some super fast chargers in the non-Tesla world that are actually faster than Tesla's ones, probably mostly in Europe. But like the new Porsche Taycan or whatever the hell it's called, that actually has like some 800 volt or That's just the power inside of the thing. Anyway, it has some even faster charging thing. But this is trying to be apples to apples. So you can play with this. We'll put the link in the show notes to the website you can play with and look at it. But if you say, okay, set aside the super fast chargers, what about just chargers, period? The numbers go even more in favor of the non-Tesla things. there is still the option of like, well, what kind of connector do you want? Because there are a couple of different connectors, right? So you can figure out based on where you live and the car you're going to buy, like look at what connector the Bolt has and how fast charging the Bolt can even accept. This is, I think, is a useful website for figuring out what your charging options are. But Tesla has the advantage of like, all superchargers, as far as I'm aware, are more or less uniform.
Pretty much. I mean, there is variety between them, but it doesn't really matter. Like, it's variety in ways that most people don't care about.
But are they all fast?
They're all fast. Yeah. Like I forget like exactly like the specs for like certain, you know, DC fast charging SAE standards kind of thing. But all superchargers are considered like the fast kind. I think like level three, I think it is, or whatever it is. But I think one major advantage that the superchargers have is they appeal to you in the same way that like fast food restaurants in highway rest stops appeal to you. When you're on a road trip, you know exactly what you're going to get. You know that if you are driving a Tesla, you know that you can drive pretty much anywhere, you know, at least in the countries that they cover, and they cover the U.S. very well there, and they're getting pretty good in Europe and Canada too. But you know that if you drive somewhere, you don't have to look up in advance, like, wait, what is the supercharger? Is it actually, like, is it somewhere nice? Is it going to actually be there? Is it going to work? Is it going to be enabled? Am I going to be able to pay for it? Is it going to have the right adapters or whatever for my car to plug into it? Like, there's a whole bunch of question marks around a lot of this stuff because, the charging infrastructure in general is still in its early days, you know, in the whole world. And so with a supercharger, you know, if you drive a Tesla, you know that you can go to supercharger X, Y, or Z. You can even tap on the map in your car and it will tell you whether they're full or not and how many bays they have and how fast of a charging rate they support, and they're all fast. And you know exactly what you're going to get. So there's a level of like predictability that, for the same reason people choose to eat fast food on road trips, because they know exactly what they're going to get and they don't have to take any risks. Same reason, and oftentimes in the same places, you get Tesla supercharging. If you go outside of the Tesla world, you just have to do a bit more legwork. You have to do a bit more research. Like, if you're going somewhere, you should probably look up ahead of time. Like, not just looking at like a point of the map of where a charger is, but look in more detail of like, has someone posted photos of this charger? Where exactly is it? Will it work? You know, all these little things you have to additionally check. So by going Tesla, you actually do have this kind of peace of mind that you know exactly what to expect. You know, it'll be there. You know, it'll work. And in most cases, you know, it'll be free, and so you don't have to worry about like, how do I pay for this and everything. So it's just kind of a nicer system. And I'm not saying that we can't ever get there. Like, you know, we got there with gas stations. It probably took a while when gas stations first came out. Like, gas stations probably had similar issues. But now you know that you can drive anywhere in America and most of the world. You can drive anywhere and you can stop almost anywhere you would possibly need a gas station, and there will probably be one. You can probably find one that is open at all times of the day, and it will work with your car, and it will take your payment, and you kind of know, like, the infrastructure is mature enough that you know that's there. With electric, we aren't quite there yet outside of the Tesla world. It's still very young, and there's still a lot of questions that you need to answer, but with Tesla, you can be sure, and that's actually a really nice thing.
I think there is a fast food aspect of the non-Tesla things in that there's so many more of them, and not all of them are like the full service fancy McDonald's. Some of them are just like the quick McDonald's. Some of them are just drive-throughs. Like, some of them, the equivalent is like, some of them are not the super fast charging. Some of them are slower charging, but there are so many more of them that the odds are, if you throw a rock in some direction, like, what is the closest charger? The supercharger, there's maybe one or two around you, but there's like 75 of these other dinky things, only one or two of which are the fast chargers, but the whole rest of them are, you know, all around. So it's like the ubiquity is, I feel like, starting to become a factor with these other charging things. And there's more variety, and they're not all fast, and so on and so forth. That's why the comparison here is fast to fast. And I think fast to fast, there's more or less parity, albeit with the variety that you mentioned of like, well, how are they and how nice are they? And the second advantage is, if and when Tesla goes out of business and or is acquired, these independent charging stations will still exist, because as far as I'm aware, they're not affiliated with any individual car manufacturers, but are just like, we charge you money for electricity stations, or like they're third party companies whose only job is selling electricity to people with electric cars or whatever. Like, I don't think they're like, there's a Volkswagen station and a Porsche station or whatever. So I'm not sure what will happen to all that supercharging infrastructure if Tesla decides to get out of that business or gets acquired or goes out of business or something. But, well, you know, the idea that you would have to go to a specific gas station for your specific brand of car is not tenable long term, and I feel like is just an anomaly here at the beginning of the the electric car era. And, you know, Teslas will be fine. They can use the other chargers too, right, with adapters or whatever. So it's not a big deal for the cars, but it seems like something they can't hold forever.
You know, I have to ask, and I'm looking mostly at you, John, are Tesla fans today better or worse than the dark era of being an Apple fanboy? What I mean by that is, if you say anything that's even mildly negative about Tesla anywhere on the internet, there are a lot of very, very angry people that will come out of the woodwork to tell you that anything other than a Tesla is a waste of money and is a terrible decision. And by the way, you're murdering the planet. You personally are murdering the planet. Nobody else is, just you, by besmirching Tesla. And I feel like
they're kind of right.
Just proving my point. Anyway, what I can't help but wonder is, like, were the Mac people and the Apple people just as bad in the heyday? I surely hope not, because the Tesla fans are just intolerable. It's gotten to the point that, like, even if I wanted a Tesla, I don't know if I want to be associated with Tesla. Now, I got over that for the BMW.
Yeah,
for
you
sure,
got a BMW.
Exactly. I will be the first to tell you, I got right over it when push came to shove, but oh my word, the fans are so obnoxious. And Elon occasionally can do wrong, but Tesla as a corporation can do no wrong. There's nothing wrong with anything Tesla does ever.
I think the Apple fans probably were just as bad, but they had the advantage of the internet not existing in its current form. So they just had to be bad in isolation. Like, their badness was not allowed to, like, the way their badness filtered to people was like actual physical letters that they would write to like op-ed columnists who said bad things about Apple or Macs or something, right? So it was, they may have been as bad, but it's not, the exposure wasn't as bad. Like, the experience of being around them wasn't as bad, because there wasn't a means for them all to communicate to you or anyone else. And in fact, they wouldn't communicate to you, a random person. Like, you know, they would only communicate to you if you were a columnist, and then by letters or whatever, which were much nicer than tweets and far less numerous. Second thing is, as obnoxious as Steve Jobs was, and as clueless as the various Apple CEOs were who were there at Apple before he came back, Elon Musk is worse. So, and he is allowed, his message and his self is allowed to transmit to many, many people. So I think that adds an extra spice of awfulness to the situation. It's hard to say if Apple fans were in the current environment with Elon Musk as the CEO of Apple, I think it would be about the same. Because, you know, Apple fans were probably, I'm going to say, more justifiably angry, because, you know, it wasn't like, I don't know, I'm not going to say anything about it. I feel like the Apple stuff and Macs were less justly maligned than the complaints people have against Tesla. Let's put it that way. Because Tesla does have problems. Like, Macs were not, you know, arriving missing screws or with paint sprayed onto the tires. And, you know, like, in general, even in Apple's worst days, it was still, you know, a nice product, right? Whereas some of the complaints about Tesla are not in keeping with the supposed stature of the company. And then when people complain about them, they get defended. And I feel like there was not much defending shoddy workmanship on the part of Apple, mostly because there wasn't as much shoddy workmanship.
It's frustrating to me when I try to take a reasonable, I try to make a reasonable point. And I had said on Twitter, I forget how I phrased it, but basically, like, I think it was actually Sam Balsamit as well that had pointed out that the Roadster is basically abandoned by Tesla 10 years on. And I said, you know, that just seems kind of crappy, right?
So is my Mac. I know. I know it's not the same thing, but
fair. And actually, somebody said to me, well, you know, what about, you know, iPhones and Macs and so on? And I think there's a big difference there, because, you know, a car is sometimes the most, or maybe the second most expensive thing that any regular person would buy. Whereas a Mac, unless you're John Siracusa buying a $100,000 Mac Pro, is not the second most expensive thing you'll buy in your life. And I know you were saying that to be silly.
I don't even know if it has to do with the expense. It's more like just tradition. Like, traditionally, cars are supported for a long time. Why? Well, they just are, right? And in some ways, Tesla not doing that is treating its cars more like electronics, like phones, which it does in many aspects of its cars that are favorable. And here's one unfavorable one. I agree that it's bad because we're used to a world where that doesn't happen. but it does kind of fit with the idea of Tesla being a different kind of car company.
Yeah, but I mean, look at all these roadsters. You know, what happens to those batteries? What happens to all the metal in those cars? You know, nobody's recycling them, are they? And a lot of these owners, they want to keep these cars longer than 10 years. I mean, God knows how those batteries are working, if they're working anymore. But, you know, they want to keep them longer, and they're basically out of luck. And so there's a video that Sam had tweeted, and I had retweeted with comments saying, you know, there's a single guy, I think in Seattle or something like that, that has basically become the Tesla Roadster expert, and he will service them to the best he can, sometimes to the point of like having new hoods machine printed, I don't know the terminology, but you know, created based on a mold from an existing hood that he had made himself because he can't get parts from Tesla. And you know, we have stories of like a friend of the show, Arik, who he waited what, like 4 months for a windshield for his Model 3. And so I pointed out, like, this just seems crappy to me. And so many people came out of the woodwork, well, they're disruptive and oh, they're pushing the car manufacturers in the right direction. Well, yeah, but I don't want a car that I can't get a friggin' windshield in 4 months. Like, and I would presume that that's gotten better since, you know, Arik had his problems. But like, I don't want to.
It probably hasn't.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I don't want any part of that. And I don't think that's an unreasonable take to have. But oh, the Tesla fans were not happy with me. Oh, no, they were not.
I mean, you're both correct. Like, like one is not a counter argument for the other. Like, you are correct that Tesla has had tons of problems. I've seen problems with just like operations, service, that kind of stuff. They do have tons of problems with that. Those other people are correct that Tesla is really disruptive, and it's very helpful to, you know, all of humanity, that, you know, to push all this stuff forward as aggressively as they have. And they really have made the industry move in a pretty big way. So that is all correct. However, that doesn't excuse all their problems. And I think people on the internet are just bad at arguing, and they see any attack on Tesla as an attack on all that good stuff, when in fact, you know, these can be separately discussed issues, and you can both be correct that Tesla is doing amazing things, and also they have tons of operational problems.
Yeah.
I think it is an interesting experiment, though, to see if one of the you know, traditions of the auto industry that Tesla can break is the idea that you can continue to get parts for your car a decade later, which is absolutely standard. Like, for any quote unquote real car company, if you have a 10-year-old car, you know, Chevy, a Ford, a Honda, whatever, of course you can get parts for it. Like, especially if it's like, you know, a common car. I mean, Tesla only makes a few models anyway, but it's not like, if it's not like a rare exotic one-off thing that they made. But even then, like, I don't know, like, what the standards are for how long parts are in inventory. I'm sure someone in the auto industry can tell us, but it's a really long time. And the only real reason for it is, like, tradition, essentially. Like, I mean, I'm sure there are reasons way back when, but, like, it does make you, it is a way these car companies earn trust and last a long time, because if you, you know, once one car company does that, it's like, well, I have my, you know, Model T, and 30 years later, I can still get parts for the Model T because Ford still makes them. It makes you have a certain level of affection and trust in Ford that, like, they stand behind their product or yada, yada. Again, assuming the car company doesn't go out of business or whatever. And now they all do it because once one does it, it's like, well, we want that trust from our customers too. And it just becomes part of the industry. It's like, yeah, we keep parts on hand for X number of years, and we excess manufacture this many, and we have this math that says this is how many parts we need to have in inventory to satisfy the need, because cars do go away after a certain point and all that stuff. But I've kept many of my cars long after they were 10 years old, and it never occurred to me that I could bring it in and they would say, you know, oh, like, I dented the oil pan on my Civic on this, you know, very steep apron, because, you know, there's such low ground clearance on these exotic cars like the Civic, very steep apron on a gas station in Georgia. And that car was more than 10 years old when I dented it, and it didn't enter my head that I would go there and they'd say, yeah, we can't get an oil pan for your car. Like, what do you mean you can't get an oil pan for my car? It's a Honda Civic. It's like, oh, it's more than 10 years old. They don't make those parts anymore. Maybe we can custom design you one if we can mold it from and stamp it from another thing that you can get from a junkyard. Like, we just assume the parts will be in inventory, but there's no reason to assume that. We don't assume that a 10-year-old Mac will be able to run the latest software or will be supported in any way. Although, when I think of it, can I get parts for this? I think not. I think Apple won't sell new parts anymore for this. I would have to buy used. But different industries have different standards for that. I think probably at this point, the auto industry, the consumers in the auto industry wouldn't accept the idea that this different kind of car company says, no, you can't get parts after 10 years. But who knows? Just stranger things have happened.
I don't know. I really want the traditional car manufacturers who understand how to do service and how to do parts and things like that to kind of get a grip and start going electric. And they've all, you know, pledged it to some degree or another. But I really want, you know, an e-Golf to be more interesting than it currently is, even though it is very interesting. I want, you know, the Polestar to come out, the Polestar sedan. Now, granted, these are all probably way too expensive for me. You know, it's still early, but I can't imagine that Volkswagen or you know, Polestar/Volvo will have the kind of like rookie mistakes that Tesla has. And yeah, I know, I understand that electric cars have fewer moving parts, but they still get bumped into from time to time. You know, you still have rocks that hit windshields from time to time. So I don't think that just saying, you know, a lot of times when I complain about this sort of thing, people, you're not going to need to get a service as much because there's just less stuff to go wrong. Well, yeah, true, especially compared to my BMW, which tried to explode its engine every hour on the hour. But it's still, you need brakes from time to time. No, you need less. You don't need brakes as often because regenerative braking. Okay, yes, but you still will eventually need brakes. You will eventually need a windshield. You will eventually bump something and need a fender. Like, these are all things that happen to cars. It can just happen to you, John, I'm telling you. So, I don't know. I want everyone to be happy, and I want Tesla fans to be less obnoxious.
Take hands for everybody.
We are sponsored this week by DoorDash. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Get $5 off your first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code ATP. So look, we've all been there. You got like a long day at work or tough day at school, or if you're still working late at the office, you need to have dinner, and DoorDash connects you to your favorite restaurants in your city. It's super easy to order. You just open the DoorDash app, you choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. So not only is whatever your favorite restaurant is already on DoorDash, but there's 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities, so you actually might find a new favorite among those as well. With door-to-door delivery in all 50 U.S. states and Canada, you can order from your local go-tos, or you can choose from your favorite national chains like Chipotle, Wendy's, and the Cheesecake Factory. So you have lots of options no matter what you're doing. If you're staying late at the office, if you just don't want to leave your house, let's be honest, we all have those nights. I love restaurant food. I got to be honest. I don't love cooking that much. I love restaurant food a lot. And stuff like DoorDash is great because it expands what's accessible to you at night with so little effort. You know, I'm a parent. I can't leave the house sometimes at night because my kid's asleep and maybe I might be the only parent home that night or something. It's wonderful to have options like DoorDash. So listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more by getting the DoorDash app from the App Store and use promo code ATP in the app. So that's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app and use promo code ATP. Thank you so much to DoorDash for sponsoring our show. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash.
Apple just today has come out with a statement about the Siri kerfuffle from a week or two ago entitled Improving Siri's Privacy Protections. And there's a bunch of stuff in there where Apple talks about what does or does not happen with Siri, what does or does not leave your phone. But I think most interesting to me are the passages with regard to what they call grading. And they say, before we suspended grading, our process involved reviewing a small sample of audio from Siri requests, less than 0.2%, and their computer-generated transcripts to measure how well Siri was responding to and improving its reliability. So, for example, did the user intend to wake Siri? Did Siri hear the request accurately? And did Siri respond appropriately to the request? Siri uses a random identifier, a long string of letters and numbers associated with a single device, to keep track of data while it's being processed rather than tying it to your identity through your Apple ID or phone number. And, you know, they pat themselves on the back for that being unique. And so they move on and say, okay, so that's what was happening. Here's what's going to happen. First, by default, we will no longer retain audio recordings of Siri interactions. We will continue to use computer-generated transcripts to help Siri improve. Second, users will be able to opt in to help Siri improve by learning from the audio samples of their requests. We hope that many people will choose to help Siri get better, knowing that Apple respects their data and has strong privacy controls in place. Those who choose to participate will be able to opt out at any time. And third, when customers opt in, only Apple employees, as in not contractors, will be allowed to listen to audio samples of the Siri interactions. Our team will work to delete any recording which is determined to be an inadvertent trigger of Siri. I think there's some things to quibble about in here, but by and large, it was written for human beings, not for lawyers, and I think it solves most, but not all, of our problems. So starting with Marco, how do you feel about this?
That's a pretty good summary, actually. First of all, of these three action points, like the main three takeaways from this piece, the third one about them now being employees, as opposed to contractors, it's kind of nothing. That's not really a meaningful change. Apple always said they had the same standards for contractors that they would have for employees for privacy sensitive things like this. The fact that they're now going to be only employees and not contractors, I think, is a technicality that doesn't mean much in practice. So let's focus on the other two. The second one, that use of audio will now be opt-in, is fantastic. That's great. I think that is the way it should have been all this time. I think maybe Apple now thinks that as well. That's great news. That is the right decision. The only thing I really have to quibble about is point number one, where they basically say that the use of transcripts is not only, not only is it not opt-in, you can't opt out. Like, the only way to not have transcripts used is to not use Siri at all. And so all these employees now will still be able to review the text transcripts of what you told Siri basically as long as they want. And all of them. Like, you can't go in and delete one that where you accidentally said something that was caught by Siri that might have been sensitive information. You have no control over it. Like, basically, the transcribed text of what you said has no privacy. And I don't think that's good enough. I think Apple can do better in that area. I understand they probably do want a lot of data to train models and to have human review for making stuff better and everything. They do need a source of data. If they were really only looking at 0.2%, clearly they have enough data. they don't necessarily need all of it. There might be other ways to get it. So one example, maybe they should make the opt-in apply to both things. Make the opt-in apply to both the audio and the text. That honestly sounds to me like the right move. If people choose not to, if they see the option somewhere, maybe it's during the setup wizard, and they choose not to opt-in to the audio, do you think they really are going to know that their text is going to be reviewed anyway? It's almost misleading. I think it goes against people's expectations, and it goes against common sense. Like, if you say, no, you can't analyze what I told Siri in audio form, I think I would assume it would apply to text form as well. So now you're left with a situation where if you are concerned about, humans seeing what you told Siri or hearing what you told Siri, still your option is, don't use Siri, which is an increasingly, obtuse answer to that concern. So I think this does solve some of the problem, but it doesn't go far enough. I would like to see them go further and make the opt-in also apply to text. And if they really need more data, one thing I saw suggested by a few different people today was have some kind of report a problem button on the Siri screen when it gives you a response, the same way you see it on the voicemail transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why they can't do that. I maybe pride is one answer. They don't want to appear as though there might be a problem with Siri. But look, the jig is up. Everyone knows Siri has problems all the time, right? Like, no one is fooled by that button not being there. No one is getting the impression, oh, this thing is perfect. It's wonderfully, it works every time. It never mishears me. It never says something dumb in response. That jig is up. We all know Siri is, kind of unreliable and not as smart as we always want it to be. A little report a problem button on the Siri response UI would give them an easy way to get lots of data that is handpicked by the crowdsourced everything to be exactly the kind of things that cause problems. That here is a specific example where Siri didn't do what I wanted. Perfect. That's exactly what you want. You want people to be able to send that in, which is why they put it on the voicemail transcripts. So this seems like an obvious solution that they probably should do instead of all this garbage or in addition to all this garbage. But in the meantime, if they are not going to do that, I don't see why audio recordings were deemed private enough to have this opt-out behavior now, or this opt-in behavior now. but the text transcriptions of those was deemed not important enough to have that privacy.
I have some explanations for some of this stuff. So first of all, I think the reason that they didn't announce the thing that I originally suggested when we talked about this, like, and you just said as well, like the just-in-time reporting of a problem when people are the most primed to report it because they're angry that Siri did something dumb, is simply because that requires implementation and time, and they're struggling to get iOS 13 out, and they just don't have it. They're not going to announce it when they don't have it. I wouldn't be surprised if that appears, but they, I mean, this announcement took long enough as it was. They're not exactly nimble here. They can announce, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do that, because they can't do that yet. They could put that in development and plan it for iOS 13.3 or something, or maybe it'll be pushed to iOS 14, but they have to make an announcement now. So I think that explains why they don't have the UI solution that we all think is what they should obviously do, just because they're not ready with it. So in the meantime, the second question, why is audio treated differently than transcripts? There's a couple of angles on this. The first is, and this is silly, but is actually true, there is some protection for the transcriptions based on how bad transcriptions are. Like, if we all assume that the transcriptions were accurate, it would be like, well, they can have the transcriptions, but that's just garbage anyway. It always gets it wrong, what I'm saying. And that sounds terrible, but it's actually true. Because, like, I think in our mind, no one assumes that the transcriptions are the same as the audio in terms of fidelity. Because the audio, a human can listen to and have a good chance of understanding, but the transcription may be just gibberish, like, especially in cases where it gets it wrong, because maybe there's noise in the room or whatever. The second thing is, in the Morgan Freeman problem, as I described when we first discussed this, part of the Morgan Freeman problem is solved by transcriptions. Because if you hear Morgan Freeman's voice, and you know who it is, suddenly you're much more interested in what they're saying. This, but part of the problem isn't solved, and that if Morgan Freeman references the name of the new movie he's doing with Steven Spielberg, that would be in the transcription, and now you know to be interested because you're looking for keywords, you know, like whatever movie title is or Disney or whatever, even if you don't hear Morgan Freeman's voice. And this gets, speaking of Morgan Freeman's voice, this gets back to something that I think was clarified in this, that Gruber wrote about in his post about it, and Casey just read before. The original stories were saying that the information was mapped to your Apple ID for like a really long period of time. But what Apple says, and what is apparently true about it, is it's never mapped to your Apple ID. When they get this information, it is associated with a random number that Apple cannot map back to you, your phone, your Apple ID, anything from the get-go. Like, as soon as Apple stores this, it is stored quote-unquote anonymized. Now, obviously, if they have your voice and you're Morgan Freeman, they can figure out who you are. Obviously, if you say something that is that identifies yourself, you know, if you reference your home address or the first and last name of somebody in your family, like, it's not unidentifiable, right? But it is de-identified. And we originally had thought when we were discussing this that not only was it like mapped through Apple ID, but it stayed that way for a really long time. So I'm glad to hear that that's not actually true. They do anonymize it to the extent possible in terms of the metadata. The data itself, yeah, that might be used to identify you because you may be saying things or whatever. Again, the transcript, I feel like, being slightly better than the voice because you could do like voice print analysis or something to hunt somebody down or whatever. So I feel like the situation was not quite as bad as we thought it was. This is an announcement of saying, here's what we can do right now, essentially without changing our software in any radical way, which we hope they do eventually, right? But for now, they have to say, here's what we're doing. I'm also baffled by the transcript thing because, like, we were discussing this in a couple of Slacks in the past few days. Like, what can you do with just the transcripts in terms of getting things better? Maybe, you know, sometimes if you look at you do it when you talk to Siri and it makes a reminder and you're like, what did I say that produced this word? And sometimes you can puzzle it out. So maybe a human could puzzle that out. But it's really helpful to be able to hear the audio. So with just the transcription, what's so important about just the transcription that it has to be that it's for everybody? As Marco pointed out, 0.02% doesn't sound like a lot. But when you have 500 million users, like, it's like a million people, right? So if you just left it to the opt-inners, if everything was opt-in, probably more than enough people would opt in. You just need a tiny sliver of people to opt in. I think a sort of a fraction of a single percent take rate for opting in is apparently adequate because that's what they're choosing to do now. Like, it's not...
Right, exactly.
So it is kind of baffling why the transcripts are global. And that's the thing they could have done now. Just like they made the other thing, they're going to make the thing opt-in, which I feel like is just, you know, one screen and a preference thing. If they had made transcripts opt-in, it would have been a cleaner win. So I would love to know what the decision-making process was, you know, and why, you know, maybe the calculus is that people actually won't care about the transcripts. And I can understand the thing is the recording sounds more personal and people know the transcriptions are garbage anyway, but it does seem weird. And it is like the tiny blemish on what would otherwise be a fairly clean PR win, especially with the part about clarifying about the identification. Because I feel like that was the worst part of it, that they would have audio recordings of you that if you didn't read all the fine print, you didn't know were happening. That's something that, by the way, the people have been pointing out since the story came out. They're like, well, Apple told you this was happening. Of course they did. It's always in the fine print. But the whole point was, it's not what we expected. Like, no one reads that. We all know nobody reads it. Like, yes, it's always in the fine print, but nobody reads it. And we're basically going by what we expect from Apple. So this was, again, you know, and to Apple's credit, Apple didn't come back and say, well, just so you know, we told you about this 2 years ago and everyone was fine with it. That's not a defense, because Apple knows nobody reads that stuff, right? Apple understood the actual problem was here, expectations versus reality, and they weren't matching up, so they're trying to get them realigned. But I am glad to hear that it was, you know, de-identified from the beginning, and then they just have to address the identified stuff, which is the data, which should all be opt-in.
So in the last, 24 hours, 48 hours, we've gotten an iOS 13.1 beta, which is different since iOS 13.0 isn't out yet. I haven't seen a lot about what the differences are, other than that some things that were taken out seem to be added back. I know Federico was very excited about some shortcuts-related things that were added back in. What's going on? Trouble in paradise for Apple these days? It sure seems like 13 has been way more of a cluster than anyone expected, especially since we all thought that they had so much time to work on a lot of these features last year, in theory, although it's never quite that simple. What's going on?
And lucky 13. I mean, mm-hmm. So this, I think the situation is not particularly unexpected and also not that different. So the unexpected part is like, well, you know, iOS 12, they pulled stuff out of it. Shouldn't they have had more time to work on the 13 stuff? Well, it's not like there's a relatively fixed number of people working. So the whole point was, bump those features and get all the people to continue to work on 12, which they did. And I think 12 was a good release and it was very stable and it felt like it accomplished their goals and made your old devices faster. The reason it did that is because all those people who would have been working on those features that got pushed to 13 weren't working on those features. So it's not like those features got such a long time to be worked on. Those features were put aside. No one working on them. Like, frozen in time, and then more or less, you know, and all those people were working on 12. And then when all the 12 work was done, they resumed work on the 13 stuff. So it's not true that those 13 features got like twice the amount of time. They got like 1.5 the amount of time. And obviously they were challenging features because they're the ones that got bumped out of 12. They didn't bump the easy stuff out of 12, right? So it doesn't particularly surprise me that there might be problems. What does surprise me is exactly how many they are and how severe they seem to be. Sometimes that happens, right? And we've heard stories about not just features, you know, that they're having trouble with, but features that have been rolled back to say, like, we were working on a new version of this subsystem and it's not going to make it. So bring back the old subsystem and remove all the features that relied on the new subsystem. Presumably so that those things can come back in 13.1 and 13.2 or whatever, right? But that, if that happens, it's usually a big deal. And that seemingly happening on multiple fronts in 13 doesn't bode well. Now, as for the iOS 13.1 beta, this kind of overlap where people are working on 13.1 and 13.0 at the same time pretty much always happens. What normally doesn't happen is the 13.1 beta is distributed to developers before the 13.0 happens. Very often 13.0 comes out on the same day the 13.1 beta comes out. So it's not weird inside Apple for them to be overlapped. It's weird for them to be overlapping externally. And I think the explanation for that is, you know, rumors say that 13 was, you know, given some extra time to bake, but they have to commit to a shipping version of 13 to be on the iPhones that they're going to announce in a week or two. So they basically had to say, freeze a version of 13 for the new hardware, set that aside, continue working on the quote-unquote real 13 for everybody else, and also get going on what we know is going to be 13.1. And they have to do all of that, you know, not at the same time, but overlapping in many ways. Because as much as they can give 13 more time to bake and more time to develop or whatever, this is the question we were all asking ourselves back when they were doing this. Would they bump the iPhone date? The answer is no. The iPhone is coming out when it's coming out. It has to have 13 on it. So job one was get something that will work on the new iPhones and be relatively stable, ready in time for the iPhones, because that is not moving. And if it means just abandoning everything and rolling back subsystems to previous versions, just get it done. And then even the 13.0 is going to have stuff missing from it. And then 13.1 hopefully looks more like what 13.0 was supposed to be. So this seems like typical software project management. And I think for the most part, despite it, you know, not going well over there at Apple, these are the kind of decisions we want them to make. If it's not working and it's crappy, delay or boot it out. Don't ship it like that. We're hoping that's what they're doing. It's disappointing when a feature that was, you know, advertised and shown isn't in the 0.0. But honestly, we'd all rather have the 0.0 with the old subsystem and working and wait for the 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.3 for the feature. Like, these are all the correct decisions. We're all software developers. We know how it goes. Especially, can you imagine if you had something like an iPhone launch that was like literally apparently unmovable? Like, these iPhones are being made. They're going to ship. We need to put software on them. We need to literally start making them and putting them in boxes now. So they need to have some software that we can put on them, because if we put it on the box without software, it's not good. So like a date like that, that you have to, I feel bad for the people at Apple. And then that's just like throw everything overboard until the thing works enough to ship on a phone. And that's not an ideal place to be, but if they pull it off, like that's how the sausage gets made. I mean, if you've ever worked on any big software project, you would be lucky to have a project that is as successful as iOS 13. Most of them are way bigger disasters. So I'm kind of glad I'm not working at Apple right now. I'm a little bit afraid of the software, but in general, from a distance, I think they're doing all the right things. I say until they actually ship something, then we see what they actually ship. But assuming what they ship works okay, thumbs up.
I don't have much to add to that. Obviously iOS 13 has been way rougher than previous versions have been. And we got some rumblings that there might have been this Craig Federighi email, back in July, I think, that basically, like, they were trying to find ways to, like, buy time and move stuff around because quality wasn't good enough. It wasn't where it had to be. And so, you know, we're just seeing some tiny little part of that. Like, we're not really seeing all the details about what was done or why or what their intentions are. But what we are seeing looks like, you know, a reasonable result of that leadership decision, which was probably the right decision. So it's weird. As a developer, I really don't like it, because now I have two beta trees to worry about, neither of which are stable yet. As a user, I still don't think whatever was beta 8 of iOS 13.0, which is the last beta that was called iOS 13.0, I was using that until this afternoon, and day-to-day use, it's stable enough, but I'm still having annoying bugs like mail still isn't loading new messages in my all inboxes view until I go back to the home screen and back into all inboxes. These have been problems since the very first beta that still aren't fixed. Like, so I think 13.0 is still a disaster, but they seem to be doing what they have to do to let the iPhone ship on time. And I'm guessing, you know, if iPads wait, then maybe the 13.1 can be the first version that's on iPads, and 13.0 is only an iPhone release just to get to the new hardware. Who knows? They could do stuff like that, and whatever that ends up being, it's probably the right move if it means getting a little bit more time for the quality to get worked out.
I'm going to guess that the build that is on the phones that they're manufacturing right now is not a build that ever shipped to developers, both because it's got all the special libraries that they presumably strip out for like the triple camera and whatever other weird new features, you know what I mean? Like, but also because it seems clear that they would have to have dedicated a team and a build and a target just for the hardware. And it didn't have to have anything in common with the betas they're shipping to developers for 13.0. Never mind how far behind the betas they ship to developers are. It just seems like that's a whole different branch. So my hope is that when people open up their new iPhone, whatever, Pros, that they have a build that no developer has ever been subjected to, that it works okay, that mail isn't a disaster like you described, and that basically the day they open it up, or like a couple of days later, they'll be able to update to 13.1. Because the thing is, they need to get the software so it can be put onto the phone, so it can be put in boxes, but they don't need to send those boxes to customers, you know, as early as possible. They could try to make it so that the you can order your phones on launch day, because that's what they care about, is get your money and everything. But they won't arrive until whatever weeks later, and that's their target date for 13.1. So you take it out of the box, and the first thing it does is check for updates. It finds 13.1, and you get 13.1, and nobody ever has to use whatever shambling beast of 13.0 build they put on those things. That's an optimistic scenario, but I feel like it's plausible.
How many times has that happened, that you'd get a brand new iPhone and you would have at the very least a point release waiting for you?
All the time, if in the old days, if you didn't buy on day one. If you bought like a normal person, you'd get it and add it, it would be some version that's like a point or two back. I remember that for a lot of my iOS devices. I think it's less so now, maybe because there's a lot of turnover, or maybe because they're better about inventory. But day one, I feel like you'd usually have to wait at least a couple of days for the point release.
I don't know. I feel like that's happened to me in the past for sure. I just also feel like it's been a long time, but maybe that coincides with me just starting to buy iPhones on day one because I'm an impatient jerk. But I don't know. The idea of that does not sound delightful to me, you know, and I haven't had the experience of opening a console on Christmas morning only to have it go through 13 hours of updates, but that's just not fun. Like, I have had the experience of getting an iPhone and having several hours of trying to get it activated under AT&T. That I do not miss at all. But I haven't had like a software update like cycle that I can remember. I'm sure it's happened, but not that I can remember in years. And that just does not sound fun.
Hopefully that doesn't happen that much anymore. But I feel like the most significant experience that it may be in both of your futures is not so much when you get the new toy and you take it out of the box and it needs a software update, but the servers are down or something, but when you get a gift for your child, mm-hmm, and they want to use the thing and the servers down. I very clearly remember when we got, I think it was the original PlayStation 4, and PSN was down for like 2 days, and my son didn't and still doesn't understand how the internet works. All he knew is, why is it that I cannot use this PlayStation that we just... PSN is down. I was like, what is PSN? And why is it down? And why can't you fix it?
Please, Dad, please.
Yeah, Dad, fix it. Why did you even get this thing? It obviously doesn't work. PSN. Why PSN? I will remember that Christmas for a long time. I was sad too, to be clear. But when it's your kid, it's a whole other level.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host for running servers. Go to linode.com/ATP to learn more. I run all of Overcast out of Linode, and I have since long before they were a sponsor, because the fact is, if you need to run servers somewhere, big or small, whether you're just running like one little virtual instance somewhere, or whether you're running a whole bunch of, you know, dedicated CPU instances or GPU instances or other specialized things, Linode has you covered with their options. They are a wonderful web host. You know, I've done a lot of web hosts in my career. I've seen a lot of different hosts. I've seen a lot of different quality levels, a lot of different price points. And Linode is by far my favorite host at any price point. And they happen to be by far the best value I've seen in the business. So not only do you save money, but you get a really awesome host in the process. So their plans start at just $5 a month. They get to a server with 1 gig of RAM in the Linode cloud. You pick your Linux distro, you pick your resource level, you pick your node location, what data centers you need to be in. You can have add-on services if you need them, like managed backups or load balancing. And then you're all set. If you need any help, their support is there. They have great support. I use it here and there for various needs, and it's always been wonderful. You can resize your instances at any time, of course, up and down, depending on your resource needs. In fact, just this past week, I was expecting a surge in server traffic because of a change I made in my app. And so I doubled the size of all my web servers instantly. Like, it took like, I think I was done in like 15 minutes of doing a rolling update across all of them. Super easy to do. And now when the, you know, storm has calmed down, I know I'm going to be able to scale them right back down. And the only difference I'm going to pay is the hourly difference of the couple of days they were on, up to a certain monthly cap if I happen to hit the monthly limit. Super easy to use, great host. I love Linode. Check it out today at linode.com/ATP. And if you use promo code ATP2019, you can get a $20 credit. That could be 4 months free on that $5 a month plan. And with a 7-day money-back guarantee, you get nothing to lose. Once again, linode.com/ATP, code ATP2019 for a $20 credit. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my stuff and sponsoring our show.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP, and let's start with James Gates, who writes, in this world with everyone taking pictures, when would you, as in you specifically, hire a professional photographer? Full disclosure, I'm an amateur photographer thinking about going into the business full time, but I still think there's potential to make a living, even in this seemingly saturated industry. So this is one of the Ask ATPs, which I think I lamented in a prior show that I answered via email only to find it show up in the show notes. But my answer to James was basically like a wedding, of course. But the only thing I could really think of is times that I felt it was really important to have all four of us in front of the camera. You know, if I'm at a birthday party for one of my kids, I don't mind not only taking a bunch of pictures, but also handing the camera off to like my dad or, you know, or Aaron on occasion or whomever to take a few as well. I can't think of anything else offhand where I would be, where I would really, really, really want pictures that are professionally done. And I guess maybe pregnancy shots. Like we had a friend of ours who is a professional photographer do them, you know, but we could have had my parents. It wouldn't have come out as nice by any means, but it would have been okay. I don't know, John, when would you, as the fellow cheapskate, pay someone to take pictures of you and your family?
We pay someone to take pictures of me and my family every year. We
take yearly
yearly photos of all the kids or whatever. Obviously, as you pointed out, like the easy answer to this, and it's totally true, is if you want everyone to be in the picture and you don't want to do the tripod and run type thing, you have to hire somebody. Otherwise, you're not in the picture, or whoever the photographer is not in the picture. And so that applies to family photos, but also in general, like, first of all, I'm not a professional photographer. Presumably, and this is absolutely true, professional photographers can and will take better pictures than I will. So there's a reason you pay somebody. Second thing is, presumably, and this is also actually true, they have better cameras than I do. So there's that, right? And they have places where you can go to pose your family in front of some kind of nice backdrop or whatever. So anyway, we do that every single year. It's just a place in the mall. It's nice. They give us all the digital files. We used to have this actual one specific photographer that we went to, who we went to for, I think, our children's lives from infancy until they were like 10 or 11. And then she like went off to either be freelance or work someplace else. And we were all sad. But yeah, so that's the obvious one. The less obvious one is every once in a while, mostly on my wife's whim, we had someone come and take pictures of us, like just, you know, outdoors in a park or like in some scenic thing or when the fall leaves, you know, or whatever. And those people will do more sort of artsy things and have us do stuff. And it's something, first of all, if you did it yourself, you're the only, if someone in your family is doing it, that's just one person and then one person's tastes and ideas. Getting someone else in who has their own ideas and has way more experience than you ever will taking pictures of people and their families, because that's what they do for their living, they'll have ideas about how you can pose and what might look good and what would be cute and, you know, what angles to take and where, what part of the park to take you to or whatever. So we did that a couple of times too. And, you know, depends on the person and how good they came out, but that's the answer to, you know, why might you think of doing it? If you are the, or whoever the photographer is in your family, the only person who ever takes your pictures, there's a sameness to it. And sometimes it's nice to get someone else's eye in the mix and someone who is, you know, one would hope going to be a much better photographer than you.
Marco?
I think that that very last part is what's key to me. We, you know, it used to be back, like, you know, in the bad old days, that to be a photographer, you needed to have a nice camera and access to, you know, printing resources and things like that. And people would pay you because you had a nice camera and they didn't. And so when some important event would happen, you would take your nice camera, and you may or may not have artistic abilities or, you know, much training, but if you had a nice camera, you could be a professional photographer. And what has changed, obviously, is that, you know, in recent decades and especially recent years, everybody has a nice camera now. So that is no longer a differentiating factor. Most people, like your wedding photos from 20 years ago, you could take photos that good almost on a smartphone today. And at least if the light is good enough, you might not be able to even tell if you took them with a smartphone. And if the light isn't good enough, even like, you know, a very, very like entry level mirrorless camera would be able to do that kind of quality today. So the technology is now widely democratized, available to way more people. Also, you know, almost everything is digital now, so there's lots, you know, a lot more simplicity there than there used to be. Printing is now available to almost everybody in great quality for very little money, you know, from various online services and, you know, photo books like what John got. And so the stuff, the gear, the technology, that is now available to everyone. You no longer need to hire a photographer to get somebody who has a good camera, because chances are, if you care at all, you probably have a good camera already. But what you can't replicate is not only having, you know, another set of hands and an eye to look through a viewfinder and click a button when everyone is actually in the frame, that, you know, it's hard for you to take your own family photo, because if you need to be in the family photo, yeah, you can do the whole like timer on a tripod thing, as John said, but that's, you know, that's limited in what it can do and not easy and everything else. So there's the physical part, like you do need like another person to operate a camera sometimes for practicality reasons. But also a good photographer, which they aren't all, but a good photographer has a better eye than you at taking pictures. So it isn't just about the tech. It isn't just about having nice cameras. A good photographer is able to capture pictures that you wouldn't have captured even if you had all the gear in the world. That's what a good photographer can do. They have the eye for composition and lighting and operating the technical details in ways you might not have thought of. That's why, like, really good photographers can take amazing pictures that you and I could never take with, like, a 3-year-old iPhone. And meanwhile, we have like all these fancy cameras and better phones, and we don't take pictures that are that good. They are like a good photographer, not somebody who happens to own a good camera, but a good photographer has a better eye than what most of us have. And so you hire a good photographer when that's something that you value, whether it's for, you know, an important occasion like a wedding or family photos, new baby, whatever else. That is when you hire a professional. And there is still plenty of value for that, even now that we're all carrying pretty good cameras all the time in our pockets. And even now when you can get even better than that, you can get a really awesome camera for like $600 that is like a really nice, you know, everything. You can get all that, but you still need photographers because they know which photos to take and how to take them. And that is something that no amount of technology will ever do for us.
I think the good camera thing is still an issue, though, because we all have phone cameras, but in particular, as we've discussed when, you know, talking about the fake background blur or whatever, because nobody has standalone cameras unless you're into photography, nobody has a camera that can actually blur the background and have a shallow depth of field on it. So if that's the only reason you're hiring somebody, obviously you want them to also be a good photographer, but the fact is, who has, you know, a camera anywhere in their life who's not into photography that can take a good shallow depth of field portrait of their kid? Most people don't. Most people have pictures of their kids and you can, and there's pin sharp background with all their junky toys laying on the ground. And so if, you know, even if you had a someone who wasn't a good photographer, their pictures will at least look different than yours. And we're like, ooh, well, maybe not, because maybe people can't tell about the fake blur, but I can tell. And so for me, that would be a reason to hire someone with a better camera than me, because they can, you know, take pictures in more challenging conditions that will look good. I mean, with my current camera, you're right. The difference, especially if you're in a well-lit studio, or isn't that big. But I think fewer people now have good cameras than they used to. Because it used to be that, you know, smartphones didn't exist. And I feel like more families would have like a random 35 millimeter Pentax as the family camera, you know, even if they weren't into photography, just because what were the options? And it was only, well, this is way before your time, but it was only kind of in the 80s when, you know, these Instamatic Kodak cameras with these tiny little negatives started becoming more popular. But before that, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you'd have a family camera, and that camera was way better than, you know, the Kodak disc camera. Like, there was a dark time for a long period. And today, that camera is probably about as good, you're right, as an iPhone. But depending on what kind of lens you had for it, you might have actually been able to get a shallow depth of field picture out of one of those family Pentaxes from 1975. And today, you know, that's not true. Nobody has those cameras anymore except for photography nerds.
All right. Marco Silva writes, what do you think about message apps or services for communities? Which do you use? Which do you like using? And which grind your gears? I'm assuming this is like Discord and Slack. Is that what we're talking about here? No,
this is not. Oh. What Marco is referring to is things like Nextdoor.
Oh.
Messaging app services for communities. That's code for Nextdoor and other similar services.
Oh. Nextdoor is a complete waste of time. I'm on it. It's stupid. I wasn't aware of any others that are equivalent. So that's all I got.
I am not on any of these things, and I feel like I'm missing nothing of value.
That is correct.
Yeah, I wish I could name the competitors, but there are multiple services that are like this. I'm not on them either. Here's why I'm not. Here's why. It's not that they all grind my gears. I think they're all misguided in a particular way. So people don't know what this is. Like, Nextdoor is like a place where you could exchange messages based on your geographic locality. So you're not interested in what somebody in two states over has to say. You're only interested in what's happening in your neighborhood, you know. And so people can post things like, you know, lost dog, a rabid raccoon on the loose, construction here, tree is down on this road, whatever. And it's all like local to you. And, you know, honestly, you can say whatever you want. Problem with these services is I think it silos a particular set of concerns. Like, Nextdoor is not like Slack, where it's like, we're just a messaging thing. You can talk about whatever the heck you want. It's like, no, everyone should talk about stuff that has to do with our neighborhood. It narrows the scope to things that are happening in our neighborhood, which seems like it would make sense. Like, isn't that good to have a purpose-built channel for that? But the problem is, if that's the only thing that is sort of expected to be discussed there, it attracts the kind of people who are unhealthily obsessed with things happening in the neighborhood. Now, this includes all the people who are racist, and every time someone who walks by their house whose skin tone is two shades darker than theirs flips out about it. So there is that whole venue. But also the people who think the police are watching them, or, you know, like they're constantly worried that someone's trying to rob their house, or just, you know, general gossip, or just like, because the only thing that you can discuss there is stuff going on in your communities. Again, not technically, you probably type anything you want, but socially, like, that's what the thing is supposed to be used for. It ends up, you know, the people who are the most active are the people who are the most likely to be overly concerned, let's say, with things that are happening in their neighborhood. So it just becomes a cesspool of all the worst instincts surrounding this. As opposed to, and I'm going to almost say something nice about Facebook here, as opposed to something like Facebook, which is like, people can write about whatever they want. They can talk about the TV show they just saw. They can talk about the vacation they're just on. They can argue with each other about politics. But there's no specific topic that is expected to be discussed on Facebook or on Slack or on Twitter, for that matter. Like, these sort of more open messaging platforms, those don't necessarily devolve into only the people who are paranoid about, you know, the raccoons coming in and stealing their medicine, right? That's the only thing you can talk about in Nextdoor. If you participate in Nextdoor, either you become one of those people or you realize you are surrounded by those people. Neither of them is a good scenario. Like, it's fine to be engaged with your community, but engaging with your community is a full bandwidth type of thing. It is not a narrow bandwidth, let's talk about the dark-skinned people who are walking by my house and how they're trying to steal my packages. Like, it's not healthy for anybody. I wish those services would just go away. I think they're doing more harm than good.
Fair enough. Finally, Mike Taffet writes, what are your preferred themes or color schemes for Terminal? And I got to look this up because I don't remember. Pro, of course it is, because it's the most professional. That is my preferred scheme. When I get a new Mac, if I don't, you know, like, migrate, which I don't think I ever have actually migrated from an old Mac, I will open Terminal for the first time. It'll be blindingly white. I will go to Preferences, click on Pro, and then I won't look at it again for years, which is exactly what
just happened. Can you describe Pro? I don't know what that looks like.
It's black background, white text. I don't know. It's one of the defaults that come with, you know, Terminal.
What color is the cursor?
Gray. I don't even pay enough attention to know. So I can tell, as per usual, I am not hypercritical.
Oh, and there's transparency in the background too.
Yeah.
I just opened a Pro window. It's like mild. It's mostly black, but it's mildly transparent.
Yikes.
All right. So what is the correct answer, gentlemen?
Well, in a shocking twist, I feel like you and I, Casey, should have the reversed options here. Mine is basic.
Really going to be Dave Matthews.
Mine is just the which I think is the default. It is the white background with black text and no transparency or anything. I like regular white terminal windows. I know this is very unusual for nerds. Usually nerds want everything black, black everywhere. I like white. I used to use black like back in the day, like when I worked on Linux servers and stuff. But now I just use white everywhere and it's fine. Most of my windows are light color backgrounds. I don't use dark mode in the OS. I'm in, mail and messages and Safari all the time, Xcode, all these other apps. TextMate, I also use light background, dark text. So I'm just, I don't get the like blindingly white thing that you said. I don't see it that way. And it's fine. And I will say on the font side, I was a Monaco holdout for a very long time. I would even do the little tricks, whatever was required to make it so that even when there was anti-aliasing in the rest of the system, that my terminal windows and Xcode and TextMate would never use anti-aliasing. It would use Monaco, like pixel font. What eventually killed that for me was Retina. When everything started going Retina, there was no good way to have Monaco on a Retina screen. It just, having like the fixed pixel bitmap font just never looked good on Retina. Even if you like doubled it, it still didn't look good. So I am now reluctantly a Menlo regular 11-point person in my terminal and Xcode and everything.
Before we move on to John, so forgive me if you said this and I just totally missed it, but is Xcode white background as well? Because curiously, my Xcode is, whatever the default background is. I do use Fiera Code, I think is the name of the font, which I quite like. That's like a programming specific font, Fiera Code, F-I-R-A Code. But my Xcode windows are white, and I'm totally fine with that. But something about terminal windows, I need to have black. I think because of all the time I spent on DOS, where it was, a black screen with white text, so on and so forth. Well, sometimes green, but anyway, and sometimes orange, if memory serves. But having a dark background for something that vaguely resembles DOS to my lizard brain is, I think, a requirement, which is funny because I agree with you. It seems like you and I would be the reverse here, but we're both conundrums, John.
My Xcode is also white. The only thing is, I don't use Menlo and Xcode. When Xcode introduced San Francisco Mono, I just went with that, and so I just checked, and I'm using SF Mono regular 12 in Xcode. So I use Menlo regular 11 in terminal, and SF Mono 12 in Xcode.
John, what is the actual correct answer?
So I customize my color schemes. I enjoy the terminal is customized. My color scheme is creatively named John. And I've ported that from all... I have a bunch of schemes, actually, but the John is my default one. I've ported that from Developer Preview 2 or whatever the first time you're allowed to make settings. It is white background. I think I talked about this at length on several podcasts, but most recently on the episode of the talk show I was on. My whole thing with the Mac is... white background, black text, because that's what the printed word looks like, and that's what I always want in all my windows, including my terminal windows. Monaco 9, because I am not Retina, I'm still rocking the non-anti-alias Monaco 9.
Nice.
or trying to. I think I've actually, it's still working. I just sent a screenshot of it. Obviously, when I go Retina, I just like Marco, I will have to bail, because the time is over. But, hey, I'm staring at a non-Retina screen, and it still works for me. The only twist I have, and it's all opaque, right? The only twist I have in this, in terms of the color scheme, is 100% red cursor, just 255/0/0.
Why? That's interesting.
100% red block cursor. I put a screenshot of my terminal in the, he's got his screenshot. Yeah. I don't know why I did that. I think when I was coming up with my color scheme, I just couldn't decide, and I made it 100% red. And like, why is it a block instead of the I-beam? That's like my equivalent of Casey's DOS thing. I think it's because the block cursors in the VT220s in college were block cursors. And so I associate terminal with Unix. And so I'm imitating the VT cursor. I would never make it a block cursor in like BBEdit or something, but in terminal, I use a block cursor and I make it bright red, and I think it looks nice.
I do use a block cursor because I believe it's the default. Until this moment, I never even thought you could change it, and I don't think I will change it. But I gotta say, I actually kind of understand the red, like, because it does make it highly visible, so you can always spot where it is very easily on screen. So that actually isn't that crazy of an idea.
And I mean, why is 100% red? Probably because I just put, you know, hit the R slider all the way to the right at one point, and that's just what I stick with. And the nice thing is, if I ever need to like recreate it on a new system, it's easy to get that color again. It's not some weird like shade of taupe or something. Anyway, that's what I do. I'm kind of in a bind when I go full Retina of what font I'm going to pick. Menlo is a contender. There's a bunch of, you know, SF Mono and Consolata, Consolus. It's a million monospace fonts that I'll have to sort of have a bake-off and see what I pick. But on on the Retina computers...
A monospace bake-off.
Yeah. I don't even know, like, what is Menlo the default in Terminal? Like,
yeah, I think so.
You know, like, on my wife's computer that's Retina, like, on my laptop at work, like, I don't even care. Yeah, yeah. The other important thing is I do tweak the Terminal in lots of other ways. Like, I turn off those stupid marks in the, you know, the marking thing.
No.
I don't know if you know about that. Let me look at Casey's screenshot to see if you have it turned on. You probably do. Like, they have a thing that's on by default, believe it or not, in Terminal, if you don't have any custom settings, that every time you type a command, it puts a mark in the scroll back so you can jump back by a command at a time, which is a cool feature, but it puts like these little turds in the window.
That's what all those things are.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're thinking of. I don't think
those
I have
little
that
brackets.
On.
Yeah, you got to turn those off. That's an option. And a bunch of other stuff. I have like infinite scroll back. Like I have the preferences changed a lot. But in terms of the appearance, those little turds are another thing that I was sure to turn off the second they arrived. They came like, I don't know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, where is that setting?
I hate the settings in Terminal. Like if anyone who works in Terminal, I know it's like half of one person works in Terminal. But if you're listening to this program, please rethink the model of how the properties of Terminal windows are determined when a window was created, and how the properties of a window are modified once the window exists, as contrasted with how the settings that could be used to spawn future windows are modified. It is such a muddled mess in Terminal.
Yeah, it is.
If I just see a single window and I want to change just the attributes of that window, but not the attributes of the preset that we use to create that window, it drives me mad. Plus, there's a bunch of other options that are in the menu. Someone just needs to rethink that UI, but that's never going to happen because Terminal is low priority. So I'm just glad all these features exist.
Do we want Apple to rethink Terminal? Really?
Just the UI of like, decide if it's going to be like have a set of presets and have them totally divorced from the settings of an individual window, but have the UI be the same for both, but make it clear when you're editing just the attributes of one window versus when you're editing a preset. Like, I feel like we have the technology to do this, but anyway, the marking thing, I have no idea where it is. I would have to dig it out. It took me a while to figure out what it was when it first came out, and then once I turned it off, I forgot where the heck it was. But it's in either the menus or the settings somewhere.
Well, thanks to our sponsors this week, Linode, DoorDash, and TechMeme Ride Home. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
You can make your cursor an underline. Ugh.
Why would you do
monstrous
that?
And you can make it blink, of course. So none of your cursors are blinking, right?
No.
No.
All right. Just making sure. You can't see it in a screenshot, so you never know.
I have to have, like, for most of the time I am working at my computer, including right now, even when I'm not actually, like, coding, the vast majority of the time, there's a terminal window, at least one terminal window, visible on my screen. So it can't look too crazy. And if it was like a blinking cursor, like all the time on my screen, like off in the corner or off to the side.
I don't know if it blinks in the background. It might just blink in the foreground. I've never turned it on, so I don't know.
I don't even want to try it.
Casey's Mac is predictably called Casey's Mac. Andy has that name without the apostrophe, but with a hyphen shoved into his prompt.
Again,
be civilized and give a short name for your computer to appear in the prompt, or omit it entirely, because honestly, do you need to know that? I mean, maybe you do need to know what machine you're on, but I feel like you could just call it iMac or give it some other name that is an identifier. But Casey's iMac without the apostrophe and with a hyphen is not good. And with capital letters, it's throwing everything off there.
Like a monster, like an animal even.
That is really bad.
Whatever.
His hard drive is called Macintosh HD.
I don't know. Is that true? That's probably true. Let me volumes.
Casey.
Yep, that's correct.
Mine is also called Macintosh HD.
Yeah, I think we went over this one. We had like an Ask ADB question of what we name our hard drives. You two are not longtime Mac users. Don't know that you have to rename your hard drive.